Good afternoon. You're listening to the Buckmaster Show here on KVOI 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. I'm Dylan Smith, the editor of the Tucson Sentinel. I'm sitting in for Bill today. He's on vacation. Joining me here in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio is Paul Ingram, our senior reporter at the Tucson Sentinel.
Good afternoon.
And on the live line is Jim Small, the editor of the Arizona Mirror, calling in from Phoenix. Thanks, Jim, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So we're heading right down to the wire of this election. The deadline to register to vote is next Tuesday, I believe, and early ballots go out very soon after. Last night we saw the one and only U.S. Senate debate in Arizona that's going to take place. And Jim Small, do you think this debate changed any minds?
I don't know. I mean, I think we've seen there's been a lot of polling done on this race, and while polling is certainly tricky, and I think it's gotten murkier to understand in recent years, you know, it generally all tends to show the same thing, which is that Mark Kelly has a slight lead in the race, anywhere between, you know, maybe 4 points and 8 points, depending on the poll. And that Blake Masters, I think, in the last couple of weeks seems to be kind of narrowing that gap a little bit as the election draws near. Debates are important. And while they may not change the minds of, you know, committed partisans, there are a number of people who are you're kind of on the fence. And I think in this race, this is not limited to just the U.S. Senate race, but I think most of the big ticket races here in Arizona, I think what you're looking at is a situation where you have a Trumpist Republican running against Democrats who are largely trying to position themselves as kind of the more moderate or centrist choice. And Mark Kelly showed us how you know, really how he would do that in 2018, or excuse me, in 2020 when he won the special election, and he's really continuing the same tack this time. And the debate really, I think served to highlight what are some pretty stark differences between these two candidates. Between Mark Kelly's record over the past 2 years in the Senate and Blake Masters, the kind of upstart candidate, a venture capitalist and a close ally of Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel, and kind of what his new vision for Arizona looks like. The vision he's kind of putting now for Arizona in the general election is in some ways pretty dramatically different from the one that he said that he was going to do when he was running in the primary. I thought one of the things that Mark Kelly needed to do in that debate, and that I think he did pretty well, was essentially not letting Blake Masters off the hook for things that he had said before and policy positions he had staked out before. And Masters' response was to really try to moderate and try to step back and step away from some of those things and deflect those attacks by going on offense against Kelly and really repeatedly trying to tie him to Joe Biden.
So you brought up Donald Trump, Jim Small. Donald Trump was hardly mentioned during that debate last night, even though Democrats across the country and Kelly in his campaign has really, pointed to Donald Trump to try and, stir up the Democratic base and those other voters who may be disaffected from the Trumpist movement. And Blake Masters in the primary really ran as the candidate, the choice of Donald Trump. Why no mention of him at all?
Well, from Blake Masters' perspective, it makes perfect sense, right? Donald Trump is generally not popular. He may be more popular in Arizona than Joe Biden is, but he is not popular, and he's
not
in particular
much, though,
not popular.
Right?
No, it's not. It's really not. But he's in particular, though, he is unpopular among independents and among kind of center-leaning Republicans. And those are the votes that Blake Masters needs to capture. Those are the votes he has largely been hemorrhaging in the polling. And so the fact that Blake Masters didn't bring up Donald Trump and didn't cloak himself in kind of the MAGA universe and the MAGA rhetoric made perfect sense. I was a little surprised that I found it a little curious that Mark Kelly did not try to do that and try to really emphasize the fact that Blake Masters will be a vote for Trumpism and will do the bidding of kind of the Trump and MAGA world. that was, you know, like you said, in a lot of the campaign materials and ads and stuff like that, we've seen that, and that's been a point that they've made, and they've really tried to make sure that voters understand the connection between Blake Masters and Donald Trump. That it didn't happen in the debate actually did kind of I found curious,
Instead, Senator Kelly kept repeatedly. Directly referring to, quote, my opponent, Blake Masters, over and over and over again, while pretty much avoiding bringing up Trump. He did come up at one point, you know, some 40 minutes into the debate, but kind of obliquely. Do you think the sort of more exposure to the Libertarian candidate, Mark Victor, will have any effect on the race? Third-party candidates generally fly pretty much under the radar and kind of pop up for a debate here and there. He was pretty outspoken during the debate last night, especially going after Blake Masters.
Yeah, he was, and I think, you know, the presence of a Libertarian on this ticket is going to be a problem for Blake Masters, right? I mean, this is going to be a close race, no matter how you look at it. This is going to be a really close race, and you know, because you have Republicans and even right leaning independents who are uncomfortable with Blake Masters, and largely these are going to be the same folks who were uncomfortable with Trump and don't like the state of the party and the direction of the party under Donald Trump, and so. You end up in a situation where you might have, you know, those voters don't feel maybe comfortable voting for Mark Kelly, but they don't want to vote for Blake Masters. We might see them, you know, peel off and throw their votes as, you know, something of a protest vote toward Mark Victor and toward the Libertarian, knowing that he's not going to win and that, you know, that the vote is essentially going to be thrown away. I wouldn't be surprised, you know, to see, you know, if Mark Victor pulls, you know, 2 to 4 or maybe 5% of the vote. I mean, the lion's share of those votes are going to be coming from what would otherwise be Blake Masters votes.
And that could very well be the margin in this race, as you say.
Oh, it easily could. I mean, it wouldn't be surprising at all. And I don't think it would be the first time that you've seen the third party candidate kind of serve as, you know, something of a spoiler. Mm-hmm. Although I think it's important to recognize that, you know, if you had Republicans who decide to vote for the Libertarian, chances are that's because they don't like the Republican candidate, and so they may well have, you know, some of them might have, without the option of a Libertarian, might have swallowed hard and voted for the Republican. But in a lot of cases, they might just skip that race on the ballot and just not vote on it at all, or write in a candidate.
We have seen in some fairly prominent races over the past couple of cycles that undervote, where people skip over a race, even. You know, that's very common at the bottom of the ballot, where people don't understand what the offices are, don't know the candidates. But even at the top of the ballot, in some recent races, there are a lot of people, a significant number of people, who are choosing not to vote for anybody at all.
There were a significant number in 2020, right? I mean, I think we saw that in the presidential race, even more mm-hmm. than you would normally see, because you had a lot of voters who looked at it more than normal that said, I don't like Trump and I really don't trust Biden. And so I'm just going to skip it. Or I'm going to write in something that's not a valid write in, right? They're going to write in, you know, write in the name of Mickey Mouse, or write in Mike Pence's name, or write in whatever. and because those people aren't qualified write ins, those essentially has the same effect as skipping the race entirely.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's been some movement among Republicans. Like Liz Cheney came and she said specifically she would come to Arizona to really thwart Blake Masters and Carrie Lake.
Yeah, and you know, I think that obviously Liz Cheney is you know, by kind of the Republican apparatus, right? The RNC, the Arizona Republican Party. You know, I think that she's viewed as an apostate, and not really. They don't view her as a Republican at all. But there's no doubt that there are a lot of a sizable number of Republicans, a minority for sure, but a number of them who do look at the state of the party and say that, you know, privately, that they'll tell you that they don't like it, and that essentially their view is that they're trying to, you know, weather the storm. People who've been Republicans their entire life and are essentially trying to wait for the fever to break on Trumpism and for the party to kind of come back to what it used to be, or, you know, in their words, you know, maybe come back to its senses. If and when that happens is unclear, you know, and in the meantime, I think it presents those voters with a really tough choice. Like, do they go with party loyalty, even if that means voting for people that they detest, or do they skip out on races, or do they do like we're seeing a lot of, you know, pretty prominent Republicans and even former Republicans who are coming out and vocally supporting the Democratic candidates, whether that's Mark Kelly or, you know, Chris Mayes or Adrian Fontes or Katie Hobbs even.
Yeah, it seems like there is some Republicans, especially on not just the governor and the Senate, but also on some of the other races, people who are Republicans who are peeling away and pushing for Democrats, like you mentioned, Adrian Fontes. What do you think the effect of that? Do you think that matters?
I think it can, right? And I think it's you know, the campaigns have to do their messaging, and they have to, I think, take that message and the idea that, like, hey, look, we've got a bipartisan coalition. Here are prominent Republicans or prominent, you know, independents who are respected, and take that message and what those folks are saying to the kinds of voters that's going to persuade. Because obviously that kind of coalition isn't going to persuade people who are, you know, committed Democrats, and it's not going to persuade people who are committed Republicans and who are, you know, in the Secretary of State's race. People who are already on board with Mark Fincham's campaign are never going to be persuaded, just like, you know, the folks who are hardcore Adrian Fontes supporters are never going to be persuaded. But there is that group in the middle, and generally what we see is it's suburban voters, college-educated white voters, women in particular right now in the polling, we're seeing are breaking, siding pretty heavily with the Democrats up and down the ticket. Men are siding not quite as heavily, but pretty demonstrably with the Republicans. And so, you know, the campaigns really have their work cut out for them. The numbers in this state always favor Republicans, although Democrats have every opportunity to win. It's just a matter of what kind of campaign do they run, and are they able to go get those persuadable voters and get them on their side?
Jim Small, you mentioned how women are breaking towards the Democrats. Certainly one of the more contentious discussions during the Senate debate on Thursday night was abortion. And you have, outside of that, you have the Democrats trying to paint this election as the Rovember election, you know, really trying to garner even more support from women, especially suburban white women who tend to vote Republican. That seems to be their main target. Are they going to be able to swing enough to be successful?
You know, I think that's really the, you know, kind of the $64,000 question for Democrats right now. I mean, those are the voters that ultimately I think will decide this election. Is, you know, it's a matter of turnout. If Democrats are able to turn out younger voters, which we saw in 2018 in that midterm, younger voters turned out at an incredibly high rate, driven by the Trump presidency. And, you know, I think other things that were happening at the time, you know, Me Too was fresh, and there were a lot of things that were happening that really motivated young voters. So I think Democrats really need to get younger voters out, which skew heavily Democratic. And they also need to go to those, you know, suburban white college educated women who, like you said, I mean, predominantly have voted Republican in the past, and make the case to them, you know, about like here is why. You should support the Democrats, and here's why you should cross party lines. And you know, I think the advantage that they have this time is that this isn't the first time they're going to that group of voters, right? Mm-hmm. That block of voters was pivotal in 2018. They elected Kyrsten Sinema. That block of voters was pivotal in 2020. They elected Mark Kelly and Joe Biden. They broke, you know, very heavily for them. And, you know, so they need those same voters to kind of keep that momentum up in 2022.
We need to take a quick break here on the Buckmaster Show. I think Paul Ingram knows what we're in for here. Time to head up to Mona's Danish Bakery. It's a bit of a drive for Jim Small, the Arizona Mirror, but for everybody else within listening range, this portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the famous Danish Kringle. Mona's is located at the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. They're open Tuesday through Sunday for breakfast and lunch. Treat yourself to their mouthwatering pastries, including the Danish Kringle, MonasDanishBakery.com or BuckmasterShow.com for a link to Mona's Danish Bakery. We'll be right back.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
Delivering a $2 billion voter-approved regional transportation plan involves complex policy, legal, and financial matters. The Regional Transportation Authority is open to answering any questions you have about delivery of the current RTA 20-year plan or about the development of a new regional transportation plan for the next 20 years. Contact the RTA at info@rtamobility.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
The way we vote in Pima County is changing. Are you ready? The League of Women Voters of Greater Tucson invites you to visit ReadySetVoteTucson.com to learn about new vote centers for easier in-person voting, new voting districts, and changes to the early voting list. Get ready to vote at ReadySetVoteTucson.com. Brought to you by the League of Women Voters of Greater Tucson. That's ReadySetVoteTucson.com. Get ready to vote.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary. Home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Are you searching for a sumptuous suite on the Italian Riviera, an exploration of the mighty Mississippi, or an indulgent spa in Cancun? Bon Voyage Travel will help you find exactly the vacation you're looking for anywhere in the world. With many cruises setting sail in over 1,100 hotels and resorts to choose from with our exclusive benefits, Bon Voyage Travel's experienced advisors are here to guide you every step of the way. Visit bvtravel.com or call 797-1110.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show here on KVOI. I'm Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for Bill, who's on vacation today. Joining me here in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio is our senior reporter at the Sentinel, Paul Ingram. Thanks for taking time, Paul.
Well, thanks for having me.
I know you're pretty busy reporting on some things. We'll get into some of those stories in just a few minutes. But in the meantime, calling in from his Phoenix headquarters of the Arizona Mirror is editor Jim Small. We really appreciate you taking the time today, Jim.
Thanks so much for having me on, Dylan.
You know, Jim, a question that I had, and I was kind of thinking about as we were talking about the debate between Kelly and Masters, is we've only had one debate for the most part among all the different candidates who are competing in Arizona. Do you think that debates matter anymore?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think that they're good, and I think that they are an important exercise. It's I think essential for candidates to kind of be put face to face and to square off and talk about their views and you know, explain directly to voters, you know, why they are better than their opponent and why they should be chosen over their opponent. Do they really matter? I mean, maybe not as much today as they might have, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, with the rise of social media and the kind of the fracturing of the news media and things like that. I think that there are many other ways that candidates can get their message to voters. And I think that we've seen a shift in campaigns in kind of abandoning what had been traditional methods of talking to voters in favor of some of the newer ways and ways that they can control more directly. But ultimately, my view of it is that if a candidate isn't strong enough and isn't capable enough and confident enough to stand up next to their opponent and talk about what they believe and why, then I think that sends a message to voters that, you know, that they're maybe not cut out for the job. And I think that that's the way voters perceive it.
Unfortunately, we've seen some campaigns in which there aren't even going to be any debates at all during this election cycle.
Yeah, there are. I mean, I think the most prominent one is obviously the governor's race, you know, where Katie Hobbs refused to do the Arizona Clean Elections debate, which is, you know, what all these other debates have been that we've been talking about. And really, that the purpose of the Clean Elections debates is to make sure that in every race that there is an opportunity for a debate, that voters have the chance to see what the candidates think and hear directly from them and to see how they act and how they're composed in that kind of a situation. You know, and I think that they do provide a really good service. You know, I personally find it, you know, kind of a shame that you have candidates that don't want to do that. You know, I think the message it sends to voters is one that ultimately isn't helpful and, you know, not helpful for your cause. And if you're running a close race, you know, I think it ultimately something like that could be kind of a self-inflicted wound that could make a difference at the end of the day.
Speaking of a different sort of debate, certainly one of the longest standing debates in our country is whether the war on drugs is a successful effort. And President Joe Biden made a rather important announcement in about marijuana specifically yesterday. He's pardoning thousands of people across the country for past convictions for simple marijuana possession, not any other crimes having to do with dealing drugs, but just simple possession cases. But I think a greater impact is his push to reclassify pot from being a totally illegal narcotic to perhaps making it no longer illegal under federal law or changing its status a little bit. Tell us a little bit more about that story.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, the pardons, I think, got the attention and understandably so, because we're talking about probably tens of thousands of people really that have faced those kinds of charges. But it you know, and you know, President Biden urging states to do the same thing, to pardon folks who have been convicted of simple marijuana possession. But the idea that they're going to look to reschedule and investigate that is much more consequential and could have a much, much bigger impact down the road. You know, the president in his announcement made the point that marijuana right now is classified in federal law the same as heroin is, and is also treated as a much more dangerous substance than even fentanyl.
Which is the dangerous drug that's capturing all of the headlines right now because of the truly terrible impact it's having on people. How is pot worse than that stuff?
And that's, you know, I think that that's kind of the argument that a lot of people have, and they look at it and say, well, I mean, this doesn't make any sense, right? Like, marijuana was classified and put on the schedule, you know, at the highest level, I don't know, what, 60 years ago, 80 years ago, whatever it was. And you know, I think that there's a huge cultural shift and a huge perception as to, you know, is it really dangerous? Is it something that should be regulated and treated like a hard drug, like a heroin or a methamphetamine or a cocaine, or should it be treated as something different and maybe with, you know, still regulated, of course, but at maybe perhaps a different level? I was just going to say, I mean, I think part of the issue too is the federal government reclassifies it. That's going to have a dramatic impact down the food chain and into the states, where we have like 35 states now that have marijuana legal in some form. I want to say something like that number. And it would also allow the cannabis economy to really dramatically shift. Right now, you have a lot of businesses in these states where it's legal that don't have access to a lot of traditional banking measures because banks are federally regulated. And so banks are extremely wary of doing business in a lot of cases with companies whose business is essentially selling or manufacturing something that's illegal under federal law.
Yeah, and I think it was striking that, you know, Arizona has legal marijuana, you can buy it, but you can't, if you go through a Border Patrol checkpoint, you have this sort of dichotomy between, you know, federal law and state law, and that, you know, people could theoretically be, you know, pulled over by Border Patrol because they have, and arrested and charged because they have marijuana, even though marijuana is legal. You know, so lining up those priorities seems to make some sense.
If I can jump in here for a moment, calling into the Buckmaster Show Live Line, which is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management, we have Chuck, who has a comment.
Thank you. Yes, I do have one comment, and I'll make it very short.
Thank you.
It's the economy, stupid.
So you're done, Chuck? Well, that's that was brief. I thank you for that. I think you're correct that most elections do come down to the economy, and we're seeing some mixed signals in the U.S. economy and around the globe right now, with inflation certainly a problem. It's affecting my pocketbook, as it were, although I don't carry around a pocketbook. I think most of us are seeing that. But we're also seeing, the unemployment rate trending down, more people getting jobs, some people actually getting raises. So it's kind of a mixed bag. What's your take on that, Jim Small?
Yeah, no, it is definitely. I mean, I think for Republicans have been making the economy, I think, a central plank of their campaign. And, you know, the unemployment rate and, you know, I think there were fears of a recession a few months ago that have not come true and don't, in the most recent estimates, I don't think, doesn't seem to be likely to happen in the immediate future. So I think as inflation is getting more manageable, probably is still much higher than it has been, you know, I think it's blunting some of the campaign rhetoric and the focus on the economy. But there's no doubt that it is absolutely hitting people right in their wallets all across.
Right now is not a very good time to be looking to buy a house or even rent an apartment. But because interest rates on mortgages are pretty high right now, we're actually seeing prices around the country start to decline in both the home sales and rental markets.
Yeah, I mean, I think we see how inflation is, I mean, in part about prices, but it's about comparing certain prices of certain things. And some things have really spiked. I mean, you see housing in Phoenix, for example, spiking incredibly. On the other hand, gas prices, which were really bad over the summer, have been declining. So we see, I think you see how this inflation rate kind of moves around, but it moves around in really asymmetric ways. You know, even the cost of like a container coming from China has suddenly dropped in price. So that may actually drop shipping costs in the next couple of months.
Yeah, and so much of this is obviously tied to, you know, the global economy trying to claw its way out of the pandemic. And, you know, when we had such major, you know, shutdowns across the globe of manufacturing and of shipping and of distribution. And so, you know, it's led to obviously supply chain problems, and, you know, inflation has come along with it, and, you know, on a global scale. You know, inflation in Arizona has been among the worst in the United States, but, you know, U.S. inflation is right there with what the inflation that they're seeing in Europe, that they're seeing in South America, that they're seeing in Asia. And it's, you know, it's a difficult thing. I mean, I think leaders across the globe are really trying to figure out how to get a handle on this and how what kind of economic measures they can take to try to stem inflation and to try to protect their citizens and make sure that people aren't going to become destitute because prices are, you know, have jumped up so much.
And the war in Ukraine with Russia invading there and now basically ending the supplies of energy that much of Europe has depended on for a very long time, heading into a winter, that's really going to shake up not just the economy in Europe, but throughout the world. And we just saw Russia coordinate with OPEC to raise the price of oil, essentially, by cutting back on the supply that they're sending out to the rest of the world. We might see gas prices at the pump go up a few cents over the next few months.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is kind of the thing that we've been dealing with for the past, probably 20 years, 30 years, is the increasingly global economy. And so it really is a situation where it's like throwing a rock into a pond and those ripples mm-hmm. go out. And something, really bad that happens in Europe can absolutely affect our economy, or our economy can affect what happens in Asia or in China and across the globe. And so, those things are, become, the larger they are, the more increasingly difficult they become to kind of manage and control.
That the invasion of Ukraine by Russia seems in some ways very far away on the other side of the world, but has pretty direct daily repercussions right here in Arizona on our lives.
Oh, it does, and I mean, taking, essentially having Russian oil kind of get out of the global market or for a lot of places to no longer take Russian oil. I mean, it means that they're all competing for a smaller stockpile, smaller pool of oil in order to make gasoline and to make other petroleum products. And that definitely, is going, supply and demand means that prices are absolutely going to go up.
And the war affects food, too. I mean, Ukraine has been a major breadbasket for Europe, and Russia, of course, has lots of products, too. And the closure of the Russian market because through sanctions also means that there's goods and things that aren't moving around, too. So, yeah, I think when we talk about inflation, I mean, it's easy to discount how much I think the war is affecting this particular thing and how much it's driving it, especially over the summer.
You got anything else on your radar, Jim Small, of the Arizona Mirror? What are you digging into that we can expect from the Mirror over the next week?
Well, next week with voting, early voting beginning, I think we kind of opened the show with, the last day to register is Monday, or is Tuesday, and early ballots begin on Wednesday. So we've definitely got some coverage of the different races and the campaigns. I think that we'll have some coverage of the Secretary of State's race coming up, which is obviously a very important race for election administration. We're going to be taking a look at the different ballot propositions. There's a number of them that were several sent there by the legislature and several that were put on there by the initiative method. And there's a lot of changes that could happen to the way Arizona elections are run, the way debt people deal with debt, their sales taxes, things like that are all going to be on everyone's ballot this year. And so we're going to have a breakdown of sort of what is on the ballot, what it means, and what voters should expect to see from the various campaigns.
So basically here in Arizona, this election is about way more than what you think about Democrat or Republican and Donald Trump and Joe Biden.
Yeah, it is. It always is, right? I mean, there's a plethora of local races and of school board races and, city council races, things that are, that are very important to everyone's daily lives, but that generally don't get a lot of attention in the media. And you end up with voters who look at their ballot and go, I don't know anything about this. So I think the job for us and, for you guys and, for everyone in the media is really to try to get voters as much information as they can. So that way when they open up their early ballot or when they show up at the polling place that they have some idea of what's going on and that they feel informed and empowered to make the choice that's right for them.
I very much agree, Jim Small, the Arizona Mirror. Thank you so much for taking the time today. Take care of yourself out there. I'm Dylan Smith, sitting in for Bill Buckmaster here on The Buckmaster Show, and we will be right back.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade. Using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana. Plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com. Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100. This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org. As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show here on 1030 The Voice, KVOI. I'm Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for Bill, who's on vacation. Our thanks to Jim Small of the Arizona Mirror for joining us in the first segment of the show, running down some of the latest political developments across the state. And still here in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio is our senior reporter at the Sentinel, Paul Ingram. Thanks for sticking around, Paul.
Oh, sure.
It's certainly been a busy week in Tucson news. Most prominently, surely, would be the shooting death of University of Arizona professor Thomas Meischner, and the accused gunman made his very first court appearance late last night.
Yeah, he appeared on court in through Pima County late around 9 o'clock, I think, and went through the sort of first stage of the prosecution against him. So he went through last night. I mean, he was arrested Wednesday afternoon by TPS officers. They actually, as we learned today, actually did a pit maneuver as he was heading towards Mexico after driving past Gila Bend. And a pit maneuver is just sort of a maneuver where they actually intentionally sort of crash the car by kind of pitching into the back corner of it.
Spinning you out, basically.
Spinning him out, exactly. So, you know, so for him to go through this process, so it means that he's going to go through prosecution and we'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks.
But he faces a charge of first-degree murder in the shooting death of Thomas Meischner, and also aggravated assault with a deadly weapon because someone else who was at the scene there in the Harshberger building,
yeah.
On the UFA campus was injured by either some bullet fragments or some pieces of a wall or other debris that hit them.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I'm not exactly sure what happened. I mean, the report said it was a bullet fragment, but not sure exactly what that means. That person was treated at the scene and released, so they were injured by it, but we're not sure exactly what that means specifically. But certainly it's part of the series of crimes that Dervish allegedly committed. So
yeah, the accused gunman is Murad Dervish, who's 46. He is a former grad student in the Department of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences, which Professor Meischner was the head of. Mm-hmm. And he was expelled at the beginning of the year for after a series of confrontations with Meisner and several other professors.
Yeah, it seems like he really had a really declining relationship with these other professors. He
was, to say the least.
To say the least. He was fired from his TA job. And then he continued to threaten one of the professors throughout the year and until he, in August, he was supposed to get a protection order. That was against him. So, and so we're still learning a little bit more about what that order means and exactly, you know, how it was served. But he actually lived pretty close to the U of A. And he lived in a little guest house just about a mile from the U of A over on 4th Street. So, you know, he definitely was sort of part of the kind of U of A sort of around the community. He could come in, he could go sort of just walk back up to the U of A. And for whatever reason, we don't really know, on Wednesday afternoon around 2 o'clock, he walked up to the Hartsberger building and with a pistol and shot this professor.
This the accused gunman didn't have much of an actual criminal record here in Tucson, but apparently has a violent record elsewhere. And in addition to that, here the confrontations repeatedly in person and via email with professors, and also with his neighbors in that West University neighborhood, right?
Yeah, I mean, I went and talked to neighbors and. Really, the neighbors, there were a set of people who lived in that main house that his guest house was attached to, and they at one point told me that he gave them supervillain vibes, that they were just sure that something bad was going to happen because of this guy. They didn't trust him, and they're really, really wary of him. They caught him creeping on their porch. He acted strangely. Sometimes he would scream swear words in the middle of the night. So they were really, really edgy by him. Neighbors that were across the street were also worried about him. At one point, he managed to lock himself out of his house, and he came looking for a coat hanger so he could break back into it. And he went to the neighbors and asked for a coat hanger. And as one of the neighbors told me, they didn't want to open the door because they were just... He gave them such bad vibes that they just didn't do it. So then instead, they just talked to them through the glass in the door instead. So yeah, it seems like his relationship with all the people around him has just deteriorated over the last 8-10 months.
And in addition to that, there was an order of protection that was issued against him by a young woman in San Diego a couple of years ago.
Exactly.
He had. Reportedly attacked his own mother at one point.
Well, he attacked his father as well,
And back east served at least a short stint in prison for some crime we're not quite sure about yet. So there were a whole lot of signals that something was wrong here, and many people were aware of it. Do we know what went wrong as far as dealing with this?
Well, I think there's a couple of different issues. I mean, the department really understood that he was a danger, and they had
the
a photo,
hydrology department.
The hydrology department.
Yes.
They understood that they considered him a danger, and they put out a photo of him. They said, essentially, if this guy shows up, call the police. And they did that on Wednesday afternoon. As soon as he showed up, they called the police, and UAPD said they were really on the way. They were heading towards there within a few minutes. By the time they got there, though, the shooting had happened, and Meisner had been killed, and Dervish was already heading off, and they were spending the next part of that afternoon trying to find him. They alerted the campus, told people to, they didn't necessarily tell people exactly what to do, which is a complaint among university students and professors at this point about how they should respond, but they did tell people to be careful and said told students, in fact, that they could go back to their dorm rooms. At the same time, there's Mansfield Middle School, which is just outside campus. Mansfield Middle School was put on lockdown, which, of course, I was trying to pick up my son, actually, when this lockdown happened. So my son called me and said, we're in lockdown, and they kept the student center, which, of course, makes a lot of sense to me. You know, Mansfield Middle School has a couple hundred middle school children, and there's no, if you're not sure where there's a gunman running around,
at that point, they didn't know where he was. He had fled the scene.
Exactly. It's probably good to keep him in. So it wasn't until later in the afternoon that they knew that Dervish had actually been arrested, and this was by Department of Public Safety officers outside of Gila Bend. So it had been a little while. So the university didn't know exactly what to do. But, with that, University of Arizona Police Department really said that the departments are in part in charge of making sure that people who aren't supposed to be on campus aren't on campus. that they have a list, but that's necessarily something that their officers can keep track of. And it does make sense. There's almost 50,000 people on the university campus, at least University of Arizona campus, at least. It'd be difficult for the few police officers to say, what about that guy? What about that guy? What about her?
Yeah. So there had been, I guess, because of the, he was expelled and repeatedly confronting these professors and some students. There was a, what they call an order of expulsion, basically trespassing him from the U of A, you know, saying you cannot come back here ever again. That order was actually not ever served on him.
Right, right. And we're not sure
why. It probably wouldn't have kept him away if he were determined to do this, but it's kind of indicative of there were repeatedly things that didn't happen that could have happened that, you know, might have been able to forestall this. The big question is, how did someone who has this many red flags, who is indeed a prohibited possessor because of his legal situation, who had orders of protection against him in several different ways, how did he get that gun?
I think that's a really good question. I think that's an important question. And I think it goes back to the shooting of a constable back in August. Is that
Constable Deborah Martinez?
Constable Deborah Martinez. Exactly. I mean, it goes back to that, too. I mean, the guy who was involved in that incident, you know, he was able to assemble an AR-15 by buying most of the parts, but the final part, the lower receiver, he couldn't buy, so he convinced a friend to buy it for him. And that person is facing federal charges for lying on a federal form and for lying to federal agents after the fact. For that straw purchase, exactly. So you know, it really comes to a question. I think there's a big question about how people who have red flags, who have multiple instances of domestic violence, are still able to get a gun and are still able to carry one and then use it to kill people.
On top of the this horrible incident, the shooting death of Tom Meissner, that hydrology department at the U of A has seen several other terrible incidents in over the past couple months.
Yeah, I mean, they've had a really, really terrible couple of months. I mean, on August 19th, one of their graduate students was swept away in Zion National Park during a flood. Her name is Chital Agmanhote, I believe. So she disappeared during the flood, and then August 22nd, they found her body. And then in September, on September 14th, a student committed suicide actually in the building. So now this means that they've lost three people in as many months.
Certainly our hearts go out to Meissner's family, colleagues, mm-hmm. friends, and everybody else connected with that department right now. We've got a lot of people who are really, really hurting, and I'm personally very sorry for that.
Yeah, I think it's a terrible event, and he was somebody who I think was really well-liked, really, really highly respected among the department, someone who's researchers, among the people who do the kind of hydrology that he does, which is looking at little desert streams, and also kind of, you know, a community around him. So there's a lot of people who are really hurting right now and really sad to that he was lost.
On that somewhat downward note, we need to take a quick break here on the Buckmaster Show. We will be right back with something perhaps a little bit more uplifting from Matt Russell with Weekend Watch.
Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley, proudly announces a second Tucson area location where you'll enjoy locally brewed craft beer and gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, on West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and now at the DoubleTree Hotel on Alvernon across from Tucson's Reed Park. More on the web at noblehops.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Delivering a $2 billion voter-approved regional transportation plan involves complex policy, legal, and financial matters. The Regional Transportation Authority is open to answering any questions you have about delivery of the current RTA 20-year plan or about the development of a new regional transportation plan for the next 20 years. Contact the RTA at info@rtamobility.com. The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show here on KVOI. I'm Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for Bill, who's on vacation. I hope he's having a good deal of fun. One place where you can go have some fun is to go visit our friends in Silver City and Grant County. They're ready to welcome you back with open arms just 3 hours east of Tucson. There's so much to do in Silver City and Grant County, including hiking the Gila National Wilderness, where there's plenty of social distancing still, and visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument for a complete listing of the many things to do and great places to stay. Visit southwestnewmexico.org. A little bit closer to home, if you're not interested in taking a trip out of town this weekend, Matt Russell has some things for us to do in his weekend watch.
Indeed, your uplifter in chief of reporting for duty, Dylan.
Thank you, sir.
We can't do weekend watch justice today without mentioning Tucson Meet Yourself, that
you would be falling down on the job.
So in addition to all of the great artisans and dancers and musicians and such, 40 food vendors representing cuisine from virtually every corner of the globe is going to be there, from Turkey to Vietnam, from India to Venezuela. There's no mystery why they call this, say it with me now, Tucson Eat Yourself. It's all downtown in and around Haka Bay Plaza this weekend.
It's this. We should mention real quick that this is the first full-scale Tucson Meet Yourself since the death of Big Jim Griffith, the founder of it, so many years ago. And there's an altar set up where people can remember his contributions, not just with making that event happen in the first place, but ever so many others.
Appreciate your saying that. Absolutely.
So what else is going on if you don't want to head down to the crowds downtown at Tucson Meet Yourself?
Right. You know, we've been celebrating Oktoberfest on Weekend Watch for the past several Fridays. This weekend, certainly no exception, because Button Brew House on Camino Martin, they're going to be hosting their big Oktoberfest party all day tomorrow. And in addition to their own beer, nearly 15 other breweries are going to be on site pouring their season's best. They're going to have a German fare from House of Bratz. There's going to be a costume party, a Stein holding contest. It's going to be a party fit for a chancellor. It's tomorrow afternoon and into the night at Button Brew House. And Dylan, if you go, you can wear your own lederhosen.
My wife has threatened to divorce me if I ever get lederhosen. I really got to let you know that. You got one more quick one for us?
I do, yeah. Tohono Chul's Garden Bistro tonight and tomorrow night. They're going to be doing their brewing at the Chul. This is going to be every Friday and Saturday through November. Tasty bites, beers, refreshing spirits, Sonoran Dogs, burgers, a whole spectrum of snacks, Dylan. Things are brewing at the Chul tonight, tomorrow night at Tohono Chul.
Thank you so much, Matt Russell. That was uplifting indeed. I need to let everybody out there know that the Buckmaster Show is produced by Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, which is responsible for its content. I guess that disclaims me. I've been Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for Bill. On behalf of Bill, his longtime executive assistant, Rosemary Brandt, and the entire team here at Bustos Media, including engineer and producer Tom Fairbanks, who's been ably manning the board, have a wonderful and safe weekend.